Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and so glad you can join us today on the Ideas Network. Neil DeBull is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He is here to share his passion of and knowledge of native plants. And Neil, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
So, Neil, why native plants? Why are they such a good choice, and why are you so passionate about sharing them with other people?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why native plants make great selections for a garden situation or for low-maintenance meadows, woodlands, etc. And one of the what I call the four E's, and if you'll accept Webster's second spelling for aesthetics, because I can't have three E's and one A-E, there's a lot of beautiful...
We'll take it. But
thank you.
In that case.
There's a lot of absolutely gorgeous native plants. And we didn't really appreciate this for so many years because we were busy plowing them up rather than putting them in our gardens. The English, on the other hand, recognized these as beautiful plants 200 years ago and incorporated them into their gardens, maybe because they were exotic and from another land, but we were busy getting rid of them. And we finally woke up and said, wow, there's some really cool plants here. Maybe we can figure out how to use them in our gardens.
And so people were getting rid of them to make room for...
Corn, soybeans, wheat. Okay. They plowed up thousands and thousands, millions of acres of the prairie. The prairie is one of the most endangered ecosystems globally. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot more rainforest than there is of the eastern tallgrass prairie. So it's actually a very rare ecosystem. And fortunately, we realized before it was too late that we could actually preserve this ecosystem. And so I'm not aware of any species that actually went extinct. So many of them are used now for ecological restoration as well as gardens. So.
And what kind of environments or settings do you find native plants? I mean, I think sometimes we use prairie plants and native plants interchangeably, but prairie plants are just one type of native plant.
Yes, prairie plants are plants that like sun. Generally, we say a half a day of full sun is kind of the limit. If you have more than half a day of shade, then that's not going to be a good place for prairie plants. And prairie plants grow in sandy soils, clay soils, loamy soils, wet soils, dry soils. There are prairie plants for every situation, just as there are woodland plants for almost every situation as well.
And what kind of conditions do woodland plants tend to prefer?
Well, obviously they need shade. And then you'll find that if you have a decent soil, like a loam or a silt loam or a sandy loam, you can grow a wide variety of different woodland plants, and they will thrive in a reasonably good moisture-holding soil with good nutrients. But the place you get into trouble is in dry, sandy soils, especially under pines and oaks, where you have very acid soil conditions, very low water-holding capacity because of the sandy soils, and there is a dearth of species for that. There are still some that work there, but you don't have the same selection. Mm-hmm. So your palate is somewhat limited under those conditions.
So the more you're mimicking what those plants would be finding in the understory of a forest or a wood is what they're going to thrive in.
Exactly. And, you know, we just use nature as our model. She's been working on it for millions of years, so I think I'm going to be hard-pressed to make it better than what she's done. So that's kind of the philosophy that we use at Prairie Nursery is let's work with nature rather than against nature, and let's get rid of high-maintenance, high-pesticide, high-cost landscapes like lawns and, I mean, the mulch garden. Okay, you see a lot of gardens, there's like a few plants here and there covered with mulch. I mean, what is that all about? Excuse me. I got to tell you, I don't understand it. I like plant communities where you have a wide variety of biodiversity, of lots of different plants. And that is the second E, ecology. Okay, how do we create a balanced ecosystem where we don't have to use all kinds of inputs like chemicals to make it maintained? And it's perfectly doable if you select the right native plants for the proper situation.
Well, and even as an input in big quotes, water. I mean, if you plant plants that are meant to grow in the area where you're planting them, they're used to those. It's hard to believe, but they're probably plants that are used to the extremes we've had this week, where we had a 35 degree drop from day to day, and lots of rain, then no rain, then lots of rain.
This is no big deal for native plants. I mean, they're used to it. The lowest temperature we ever recorded at our nursery in Westfield was 42 below without the wind chill in 1995, and 108 during the drought of 1988. So you have 150 degrees without any wind chill or heat index that these plants can tolerate, and of course drought, flooding to a degree depending on the species. And the trick here really is to pick the plants to match your conditions, the light conditions, the soil conditions, the drainage conditions. And if you do that, the plants are going to take pretty much care of themselves after you get them established. And the trick here is to make the plants do the work for you. And by putting together, like in a prairie, we put the flowers and the grasses together. The fibrous roots of the grasses help to occupy the soil surface. And when you have a completely occupied soil environment, there's very little places, very few places for weeds to come up. Hmm. So again, make the plants do the work for you and meet nature halfway. It's kind of like a joint venture with nature. Okay, it's not going to be a perfectly manicured garden. Okay, I mean, you can do that. You can create beautiful border gardens with native plants. I mean, you wouldn't know they weren't an English garden by selecting the right mm-hmm. plants for the right situation. You can create beautiful gardens. So there's all different types of situations. If it's a small little garden area, go right ahead and apply the same principles of perennial gardening using native plants, and you'll have great results. On a larger area, you can create meadows that not only are beautiful, but they attract a wide variety of beneficial wildlife, like birds, butterflies, and insects. And this is another aspect that people forget about. They think all bugs are bad. Okay, I'm not saying everybody does, but a lot of, you know, we're kind of trained that way. Ooh, it's a bug, get rid of it. But insects are the foundation of the food chain that feed the birds and all sorts of other critters. And without insects, you're dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, the whole food chain is so dependent.
And not just because of pollination and things like that, a whole range of activities that are going on.
Oh, yeah. The number one food of baby birds is insects. Okay, and all sorts of other critters in the whole food chain. So insects are so important. And if I go out and I look at my prairie meadow or my prairie garden, and I don't see holes in the leaves, I'm very disappointed, because that means I'm not feeding anybody.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so our whole mindset is, oh, mm-hmm. all the plants have to be perfect, and there can't be any holes, and we spray them with this and spray them with that. Throw away all those sprays. Get rid of that stuff. Invite nature into your landscape and support nature. And be happy when you see some leaves are eaten, because you know you're supporting not just the insects, but you're also supporting the birds and, in some cases, all sorts of other critters that occupy the landscape.
Hmm. Now, am I counting right? Do we have at least one or two more E's left in your
list? Oh, yes. Right. Thank you.
The third... I don't want to leave people hanging. He said there were four E's.
The third E is energy. Let's just use, you know, the old whipping boy, the lawn. Okay. And lawns are important. You can't play croquet in the prairie unless you're really up for a challenge. And so lawn has its place, and there are other lawn alternatives too. But the traditional lawn is a very high energy enterprise, because most of the time it's being fertilized. Where does the fertilizer come from? It comes, if it's nitrogen, it comes from the Haber process, which uses natural gas in large quantities to take nitrogen out of the air. Phosphorus is not so energy intensive, but it usually is shipped long distances, either from Canada or places where it's available. And so you have the shipping costs and the processing costs. And then you have the mowing. Look at all the gasoline that goes into mowing. Mm-hmm. Lawn is the fourth largest crop in America, after corn, soybeans, and wheat.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I think it's like 45 million acres of lawn. And you spoke about water earlier. Water is becoming increasingly in short supply. And huge amounts of water are used to water lawns, like over 30% on the East Coast and upwards of 50% on the West. Of the total water that's used goes to lawns. It's amazing.
It's interesting, because I think many people would see, say, a golf course in the middle of Arizona and think, oh, what a waste. But they're not thinking of all the lawns that they're driving by every day or walking by or biking by.
Exactly. So you have a tremendous amount of energy that goes into this, as well as water, of course. And then fourth, economics. A natural landscape, a native landscape, can save you a lot of money, because you're not putting all these inputs into it. You're not spending all this labor maintaining it. So you save a tremendous amount of money. And that makes a huge difference to the bottom line.
And they're not annuals. So
yes, they're all perennials. Well, a few biennials. Mm-hmm. And occasionally there's one annual that we'll use in a seed mix just to get you some early color. But for the most part, 95% plus are perennials. And they'll come back year after year after year. So you're not replanting them. And for instance, with a prairie meadow, a lot of people will say, well, if I plant this prairie seed mix, when will I have to replant it? Well, never. Because you're creating a whole plant community. Mm-hmm. And because it's composed of various perennials, some of them longer live than others, but a wide variety of perennials, many of which will self-sow and reseed, you basically create a sustaining perennial plant community mm-hmm. that, properly managed, will outlive the person that plants it.
Wow. I have to say, our front lawn, and lawn is in huge quotes because there are about three blades of grass that you could rub together if you looked really hard. There was a nice small coneflower patch in the front when we bought the house about 9 years ago. And since then, I've just let it naturalize. And so our whole, other than my raised garden beds out there, the whole front lawn is purple coneflowers, and that's, it's right, really quite spectacular. And I leave, and the reason it spreads so successfully is I leave the seed heads up all winter so the birds can get at them.
Absolutely. It's a favorite bird food, and purple coneflower is very good at naturalizing. And, you know, when I went into business in 1982, I couldn't give this stuff away because they were all weeds. Now, this was 30 years ago. Okay, I mean, every plant I grew was a weed. We used to be called the weed farm by the local farmers in Westfield. Of course, none of the plants that we grew were in their fields because ours are perennials and theirs were mostly annuals. Right. And we have the good guys and they had the bad guys. But amazingly, the purple coneflower was the first of our native prairie plants to be accepted as a perennial.
Really?
Yes. In the late 80s, all of a sudden, it joined the royalty of the plant world and was no longer a wildflower. It was a perennial.
Interesting.
Therefore, making its way into the garden center.
Wow.
Where it had been restricted access prior to that because it wasn't really, you know, it was just a wildflower.
Yeah, okay. Just a wildflower.
So I thank the purple coneflower because it is the Jackie Robinson of native prairie plants. It broke the weed barrier.
That's great. Well, and I have to say, the attitudes towards it, at least in Madison, has really changed because when actually my naturalized front lawn was getting a little too crowded with its naturalization. And so on a free cycle list, I said, you know, prairie cone or purple coneflower plants, you know, free to anyone. I had dozens of people emailing me.
Oh, I'm sure.
And were so excited to get them. And I felt that I did provide quite a few people with a few plants each. And so they're definitely high on people's lists now.
And you know, it's funny, in Madison, which has a little more tolerant attitude towards landscapes, and they have a very good ordinance that allows that. And I think it's a model ordinance, and it's copied by many other communities, which allows people to have naturalized landscapes. And prairies aren't just for the backyard anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're out of the closet, into the front yard, where people can enjoy them when passersby come by and enjoy your beautiful flowers, grasses, etc. But it's interesting. Historically, people have complained, oh, well, you can't have those weeds or those wildflowers in your yard while they're spraying all kinds of toxic chemicals on their lawn. Now, mm-hmm. tell me, who is really the bad citizen here? Okay, the person who is encouraging a biodiverse landscape that supports a wide variety of life, or the people who are mowing their lawn to within an inch of its life and spraying toxic chemicals on it and consuming valuable water resources? You got to ask, well, let's look at this a couple different ways here. So.
It's Friday, so it's Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking with Neil DeBull of the Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We're talking about native plants, how to care for them, how to design a landscape, and how to keep weeds out, especially in those early years when the prairie is really establishing itself. But we'll also be happy to take your calls and emails. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can also go to our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to have you post any pictures you have of your prairie plants, your other native plants. And if you have any ID questions, Neil might be able to take a look at the photo and let you know what you have and if it's a keeper or not. And also, I'd just like to encourage people, if you go to the Facebook page, click like, you'll get updates on upcoming show topics. And we're very close to 1,500 fans on Facebook, and it would be really nice to hit that today. Larry will be back on Monday, and I'm sure he would be happy to see that. Let's go to Sarah in Madison, who has a question, Neil. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Nice to have this chance to talk to you. You guys are talking about lawns, which is even better. I was at one point, one house, trying to grow a clover lawn, and I think I kind of made the neighbors unhappy because the seeds just flew everywhere. Is that a feasible lawn, or are there many other things I should be looking at first? And I'll take the answer offline.
Great. Thanks, Sarah.
Well, a lot of people are looking at more ecologically sound lawn alternatives than the classic bluegrass lawn, which typically requires high levels of nitrogen, is not particularly drought resistant, and needs to be watered fairly regularly. And clover is one of those plants. Now, you have to be careful when you're talking about clovers because there are all different kinds of clovers. But the white clover, sometimes called Dutch white clover, and for those of you who are fond of scientific names, that is Trifolium repens, to be precise, is a legume which takes nitrogen out of the air and naturally fertilizes your grass and your lawn. And time was before we were brainwashed into thinking that our lawns should look like golf courses. It was not uncommon for lawn mixes, grass mixes in the United States, to contain about 5% to maybe 10% of Dutch white clover. Because it grows low, and when the lawn turns brown due to drought, the clover stays green because it's more drought tolerant. It forms a nice matrix in the soil, which also helps to control weeds, and it adds nitrogen to the soil. So it was considered a valuable component of the lawn until the marketing people got on it and said, well, we got to kill all the broadleaf scripts, which means now we can sell you herbicides too, nasty herbicides that could possibly affect your health of your family and your pets. So let's put some fertilizers in there too. We have another product we can sell you. So that's just kind of a history of that. So it is possible, but it's difficult to just create a monoculture of clover. Generally speaking, it's better to have it combined with grass. And the clover would usually make up a smaller portion of the total, usually 5 to 10% of the seed mix by weight, at least in the classical mix. There's also a new product called micro clover, which people are experimenting with. I've not used it myself, but it's being used as an alternative lawn. And of course, there are all kinds of little ground cover plants, over 100 different types of ground cover plants that are being used, native and non-native, many of them non-native, that are being touted as alternative lawns as well. So there's a lot of opportunity out there to find an alternative.
And for an alternative lawn, would you recommend different things, whether it's getting full sun most of the day or maybe it's a lot of it's under a large tree?
Really important. Yes, you want to always select a plant you're going to use, whether you're using plants or seeds, to match your growing conditions, which includes the light conditions, as you point out, as well as the soil conditions. For instance, do you have a dry, acid, sandy soil with a pH of 5.5, you're going to want to select those plants that will grow in that, or possibly improve the soil by amend the soil with lime to bring the pH up to, say, 6.5. So you'll have to, first thing to do always is check out your growing conditions, adjust the soil if necessary to grow what you want to grow, assuming that that's possible within the context of your soil. And then you can select what you think is going to create the right look for your situation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for that call. And let's go to Ann and Stevens Point. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. We have about 15 acres that have been in agricultural production, hay and corn, for years, and we're converting this to native prairie. And last January, we had a couple of wildlife scrapes built in the end of this. And just yesterday, they finally got around to being able to spread the topsoil portion of this. Most of the upland is still in hay, which we'll have to be killing off here in another few weeks. But we have to put some kind of a cover crop on the exposed area and on the berm, which is holding the water at the end of all of this. And I need some recommendations for our cover crop, especially for the berm, that will not interfere with prairie seeding when we get around to that later. That's my first question. We're thinking perhaps annual rye or oats.
Okay. When you say you're prairie seeding later, later when?
A year from now, probably, either next spring or in the fall. We've got on the upland that wasn't disturbed, we've got some pretty nice hay right now, and we'll take off the hay, and then we'll start spraying with a Roundup to kill it. Since I don't think we can get a soybean crop in this year, that would have been our first choice.
Yeah, it'd be more cost effective.
That would have been our first choice, but it wasn't until yesterday that they finally were able to spread the top layer out. So if we don't do the soybean thing, we're going to have to spray to kill off this stuff. I do know from having attended one of your conferences that preparation is really important. But at the moment, we have to get some kind of a cover crop onto the bare soil, and especially the berm. So my first question is, what would you recommend, say annual rye or oats, or a mixture with that and maybe some big blue stem on the berm in particular?
Okay, a couple questions for you on this berm area. You're planning on seeding it either next spring or next fall of 2012, is that correct?
Well, preferably, but part of our issue is we can't have heavy equipment driving on it, especially now. Because it may damage the structure of the berm. Although, I guess, if we get a cover crop on it and it stabilizes in a year, it'll be safe to grow over it. What I'm thinking is on the most critical part of the berm, I'm going to do a cover crop, whichever you recommend, plus maybe a little bit of prairie seed like cordgrass and big blue stem, et cetera.
Well, let's see what Neil has to say about that.
Yeah, really important question is, are there weeds in the soil that you put on the berm, or is it pretty much weed-free?
Well, that's hard to say. It was part of a hay field prior to this. There probably are some weeds.
Okay,
yes.
And that's why you want to put the cover crop on, so you can make sure and take the proper time to control the weeds in there.
Yes.
Okay, and that means you're probably going to be spraying it this summer at some point to kill those weeds. Is that correct?
Well, certainly the most of it, yes, but the critical part of the berm, well, I don't know. Probably yes.
Okay. You will find that oats is probably going to be your best choice because it's easy to grow and you've got the perfect weather now with the cool temperatures. Sometimes oats will not germinate well in the summer when you get temperatures into the 90s, but right now you have the perfect conditions for doing that in the next week or so. So I would go ahead with oats. It also tends not to reseed. Annual rye will sometimes reseed and get in the way of future planting. So I would go out there and plant oats for a good cover crop, between 3 and 4 bushels per acre, which is 96 to 128 pounds per acre. And that will give you a good cover crop that should hold your soil. And if you want, you can spray the weeds that come up after you put the oats down to eliminate them prior to planting your prairie. If you're going to plant your prairie this fall, you'll want to do it in early to mid-September with another crop of oats in order to hold the soil so you get good establishment of the oats on the soil before winter to hold it in place.
Okay, my thought was to not plant the prairie until a year from this fall, because I think I have to do more. Well, I've got some good hay that I have to kill off on the upland part, but perhaps on the portion of the berm that's most critical, I could actually do an oats prairie mixture on the berm.
Yeah, you're going to want to keep that vegetated the entire time. Preferably, you'd want to get... See, that's why I asked if you had any weeds in there, but it sounds like you probably do. It'd be really good to get that vegetated now with your final perennial vegetation. But if you've got weeds from the hayfield, that's problematic. And here's a little trick if you're going to do this in the future. Before you make the scrapes, spray the weeds on it to kill them before you do the excavation, because then you will have almost weed-free, hopefully weed-free topsoil, because you killed the weeds before you excavate it. And that's a really important trick.
Good luck with that project, Ann. It sounds like several steps coming up. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, talking with Neil DeBolt, the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about native plants and how to control weeds in your prairie plantings with Neil DeBolt, the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. And Neil, we have several people on the phone who would like to join in, so let's go right back to that. Let's go to Katie in Delavan. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I always learn from Neil. Anytime I hear him, I almost need to take notes because I never fail to learn something new. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Katie.
I had a small prairie in my front yard in Madison, which neighbors began to accept, and unfortunately I had to leave it last year. And I'm starting the same thing here, only it'll be bigger. And I was wondering, other than the National Wildlife Federation, do you know of a sign that I can put out for education for people who are looking at this, you know, and kind of wondering?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Wild Ones. Are you familiar with the Wild Ones?
Yeah, I'm in that.
Okay. They have a natural landscaping sign that they...
Yep. Okay.
Okay, you familiar with that?
Yep.
Okay, that's a good one. And some people make their own, although that's a little more work.
Yes, right. Yeah. And I've got enough work doing... I have a kind of a unique way of starting my prairie when it's little. I just take a big shovelful and literally turn it over. And that's how I did mine, because I needed to get it started right away. And then I just took topsoil and filled in all the, you know, little holes and plopped plugs in.
Oh, sure.
And it worked great.
Sure. You removed the existing vegetation physically.
No, I just turned it all over.
Really?
By hand.
Okay,
yeah.
So, but to kill what was growing there before, is that correct?
Yeah, and then it composted, right. You know, because it was bad soil, it composted.
I see.
It works for, you know, like 300 or 400 square feet.
Sure, sure.
But anyhow, I moved from Madison to what I call Hosta Haven. Apparently in my neighborhood, people only know about hostas, and it kind of makes me crazy, frankly. So I would recommend, I have fallen in love with heartleaf aster.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if your nursery, I was actually just going to your website when you came on. I love that, and it spreads, and it's full, and it's low maintenance, and it takes anything, and you don't have to water it.
Yep.
And my other favorite, my new favorite that I never knew about was small bush honeysuckle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is another thing. And then the New Jersey tea, which I actually first saw at your nursery and fell in love with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ring my whole nursery with small bush honeysuckle and Indian currant and New Jersey tea.
And you'll have hummingbirds like crazy.
Really?
Absolutely. Because the hummingbirds love the flowers of the honeysuckle. And they will come to the New Jersey tea, even though the flowers are not red, nor are they tube-shaped. Amazingly, and I was so stupid, I would go out and watch this. Like, why are all the hummingbirds on the New Jersey tea flowers? I just didn't get it. And then I realized the New Jersey tea is pollinated almost exclusively by miniature flies.
Ah.
You will never see a housefly there. Okay? Little
wow.
bitty flies, some of them almost microscopic. Amazing diversity of flies, creatures you never knew existed. And this is what is so cool about the prairie. You look at the insects there and the spiders and all these amazing critters that live on these plants. It's mind-boggling. And again, like I said earlier, they are the foundation of the food chain, especially for birds. And the hummingbirds were coming to the New Jersey tea specifically to eat the flies.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're cool little shrubs, too.
Amazing, yep.
So I was thinking, since I'm going to have a larger prairie, if I ring it with these small shrubs, does that make sense?
It makes
then
sense.
I can just mow right under them, and I don't have to worry about edging everything.
Sure, and you're going to use mowing management, burning management? Which one?
I'm hoping I can do a burn if I can get some... volunteer firemen or something.
Okay.
It's not going to be a big area. It's probably only going to be like 500, maybe 600 or 700 square feet.
Ah, you can do that yourself with a hose, as long as it's not near wooden buildings or vinyl siding. Beware the vinyl siding.
Yeah. See, it's going to be maybe 10 feet from that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Too close?
Is it vinyl siding?
It is.
Well, you're going to want to have the hose on the vinyl siding, not anywhere else. the heat from the prairie burn can do a number on that if the wind is in the wrong direction.
When I did this in the city, I just went out like in February, and I did like one clump at a time.
Uh-huh.
I just took a match and just did it. And then when I could tell people were starting to get nervous, I would just, put everything out,
right.
Run in the house. And by the time the firemen were there, there was nothing going on.
Well, I would suggest another alternative is, in many cases, people cannot burn their prairies. But almost as good is taking a weed whacker or a closely set, low-set lawnmower and go in and mow everything right down to the ground, usually in the third to fourth week of April.
Hmm.
Which is usually the time when we would burn a prairie, depending on the type of prairie. So if you can't burn, just go in and whack everything down. I mean, literally right down to the ground level in mid to late April. And that is almost as good as burning.
Great. Well, thanks for that call, Katie. And let's go to Lynette in Hubertus. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, good morning. I have a hill that I am trying to establish wildflowers on for continuous color throughout the summer. And about a third of it is doing quite well with flax and I think some phlox as well. And I'm trying to get some purple coneflower in there, etc. I really like the look of the Dam's Rocket that's going on right now, but I understand it is an invasive. Is it not a good idea to encourage the Dam's Rocket to establish itself on this hill? Is it going to take over everything?
Well, as with everything in life, it depends what you want. Okay, Dame's Rocket can be highly invasive, so as a neighborly gesture, I would generally not recommend planting it. It's a non-native plant. It's very beautiful. A lot of people think it's phlox. It's blooming right now. The way you tell Dame's Rocket from phlox is that phlox has 5 petals on the flower, and Dame's Rocket has 4. And because it's in the Brassicaceae, the cabbage family, it has 6 stamens, 2 exserted and 4 lower, which you don't really need to know that. But
counting the petals is probably
we'll go with the petals. Okay, but it can be highly invasive, and the worst thing you could do is introduce it somewhere where it is not already established and then create a pest for your neighbors and possibly for yourself. So I would generally recommend that you not use Dame's Rocket.
Okay.
There are so many other wonderful plants. There are many species of phlox, native species of phlox that you can use. Phlox pilosa, the, I can't remember the dog, downy phlox, fantastic plant. And it will grow on a well-drained site. If you have a wet area, there's marsh phlox. And if you're in the woodland, there's wild blue phlox. So there's all these wonderful native phloxes to use that are equally as showy and more beneficial.
And that will probably do very well without the risk of just running rampant.
Oh, yeah, these plants don't run rampant. Yeah. No, they're pretty well behaved. It says right on their report card, plays well with others. So they're okay.
Good. Well, thanks, Lynette, for that call. Let's go to Kathy in Fish Creek. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Good morning. I have a problem. I don't think it's a wild flower, but it acts like a wild flower. I have an Unemone sylvestris, and I planted this when I planted my garden, and it's been pulled out many times, and it never goes away. I can't get rid of it. It overtakes everything. It cuts out, it even cuts out the life on a hosta.
Yeah, it's one of these non-native ground covers that you put it in with all the best intentions, and it takes over, and then you wonder, why in the world did I plant that? And a lot of anemones creep by underground rhizomes. And that's why you can't get rid of it, because every time you pull it, there's a rhizome remaining in the soil that just resprouts. And it can move very rapidly. In fact, we have a native anemone, Anemone canadensis, Canada anemone, or as one of my clients came to call it, Canada enemy. Beautiful, beautiful plant. And if you need a ground cover in a wet, low area, it's fabulous. But it's generally not used in the garden because it has the same characteristics as your non-native anemone sylvestris. So,
you get rid of it. I was thinking, I was thinking spray the whole garden to kill it, but then I have other things, and I have a tree in the garden.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about digging out all the dirt.
You can dig out the dirt and sift out the rhizomes. This is an extremely laborious process, but it will work. And if you invariably miss some, which probably will happen, you have to be Johnny on the spot as soon as they come up after you've sifted that soil to get them out of there. Sometimes it'll come up in large hunks as you dig it out. Have you tried to dig it out in large areas?
Not yet.
Okay. It's really, you know, these rhizomatous ground cover plants like Snow on the Mountain and things like this, which people bring home a little bit of and then end up with, you know, half an acre, and they go, oh my God, they rue the day they did this. So you want to be really selective about these quote-unquote ground cover plants that you bring in, especially if you're not familiar with them and if they're non-natives, or even some natives like the anemone canadensis.
Great. Thanks for that call, Kathy. And actually, Bonnie had a question on Facebook. How do I conquer reed canary grass that likes to creep into the prairie? We have sandy soil, and she's in Hobart, Wisconsin.
Oh, my God. How much time do you have? Reed canary grass, Phalaris arundinacea, a horrible plant that was planted widely and produced in Wisconsin, planted widely for establishment for forage for farm animals, for cows, etc., horses, in low moist areas. And there were big farms here that grew the seeds, and that's why it's so widely distributed now, besides the fact that it's highly invasive. How do you get rid of it? It's really, really tough. It's rhizomatous. It spreads by seed. It spreads by runners. It forms big patches. It depends on your situation. When we have big infestations in natural areas, and this is a really interesting process, you can burn it when it's in full bloom, which is like right now, middle of June, which is a horrible fire because you're burning all this green stuff and it's smoky and nasty and acrid. But wow, it puts a world of hurt on the reed canary grass. And then this is assuming you have some sedges and other native plants in there. They will come back much more readily after the burn than will the reed canary grass. If you don't want to burn it and inhale all that nasty smoke, then you can mow it if the area isn't too wet.
Do that really low mow.
And do it really low mowing in mid-June, and that really whacks back the reed canary grass. It will not kill it, but it changes the balance of the ecosystem so that the native plants, the sedge meadow plants, which we call them, the sedges, in wetland or semi-wetland wildflowers, will come back more aggressively or more mobetta than will the reed canary grass. It really hurts the reed canary grass because you're doing it at a time when it's really vulnerable. But in a situation like you're in, some people will just spray Roundup at the edge to keep it from invading. If you have flowers there that you don't want to harm, there are grass selective herbicides like Post or Fusilade or Select. These are just some of the names. They only kill the grasses. They will not hurt broadleaves, trees, shrubs, etc., unless they're monocots, because it only hits basically grasses. So that's one way you can do it without harming something else, but it will kill your lawn. Okay, so if you have a lawn area and you spray some of these grass selective herbicides on it, it's not just going to kill the reed area, it's going to kill your lawn too.
Well, actually, and that question was from Bonnie. Bonnie also posted a lovely picture of their savanna backyard with huge red oak and lots of prairie plants. And she says they were planted from seed in 1998, all from Prairie Nursery.
Oh, Bonnie Vosteg, sure.
And so if people want to see Bonnie's lovely savanna backyard, you can go to the Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. Bonnie posted that there. She says, blooming are queen of the prairie. Butterfly weed, pale purple coneflower, and oxeye sunflower. And I just blew that up so Neil can take a look at that.
Wow, it looks great.
Yeah, so thanks a lot, and good luck with that grass. Let's go back to the phones and go to Mickey in Superior. Hi, Mickey.
Hello. I am calling. My partner and I are looking to buy our first home here in Superior. And you mentioned earlier in the show about knowing stuff about city ordinances. And I actually have two questions here, but city ordinances and neighbors and all that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of wondering, like, who do I talk to in the city to find out what the rules are about the house that we're looking at very seriously, small lot, and we want to convert a lot of it to native plants and edible landscaping and whatnot. So that's the first question, is kind of who do I talk to find out about the rules with that? And then secondly, do you recommend like reading books about native plants and edible landscaping, or having somebody from a nursery kind of come out and look at the lot and say, well, you could do this and that and the other thing? And I will take my answers off air.
Great. Thanks, Mickey.
Okay. I would start with the zoning department of your local city government. That's usually who is in charge of ordinances. If not, they will direct you to the appropriate part of the government. And as far as developing your landscape, of course, the more you can read and the more you can read books, you can. There's a ton of information online on various topics. And once you have a little better idea of what you want to do, then it would pay to hire a professional who can come in and assist you with this and make sure that they have the credentials to be able to really assist you with the specifics you need. And obviously, the absolute best method is the way I learned to do this, and that's by experience. Make a whole ton of mistakes. How do you get to be an expert? You make all the mistakes. So go out there and experiment. Try this, try that, try this, try that, and you'll know more about it than anybody else, especially with regards to your own special growing conditions, your soils, light conditions, etc. And it also gives you opportunity to experiment and see what things you really like and what really works for you in your situation.
Great. Good luck with that. And geographically staying in the same area, we had an email from Diane in Cornucopia. How can I landscape on a new construction site in a very heavily wooded area to look somewhat organized, but hopefully no mow?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Okay.
So it sounds like it's shaded. It's far north. And she'd like a no mow.
Okay. That's a little, need a little more information here, but what often happens in new construction is, as we spoke earlier with the woman who had created the scrape in her hayfield, when the soil is moved about, if there are weeds or anything in that soil and they are then replaced as topsoil, if there are seeds or roots that are viable, they will come back and cause weed problems. This is particularly true of things like quackgrass, Canada thistle, things that have rhizomes that are not killed by the actual excavation process. So you want to make sure that you don't have any weed problems before you start installing your plants or seeds, because the rhizomes will sit there and all of a sudden, voila, up they come. And you're like, oh my God, I didn't know those were there. And now you've already planted your plants and your seeds and you have a big problem. So that's the first thing to do, is determine, do you have living roots or other kinds of weeds in there that you need to get rid of first? If so, then you need to either go dig them out if you can find them, wait for them to sprout so you can find them, and then dig them out. That way you don't have to use any herbicides. Or you have to wait for them to come up and regrow to the stage where they can be killed by an herbicide, which can take up to 2 or 3 months because they have to redevelop their roots and their leaves. It's going to be a real, real problem, which again is why I say if you're going to do soil disturbance and you're going to then want to seed something, kill the weeds before you break the soil. So important. It makes your life so much easier down the road, and it's a very simple step before you get there.
So it sounds like first step is for her to make sure that she doesn't have weeds already in there.
Correct.
Once she's hopefully sure of that, would she be looking more at woodland plants?
It really would be, because if it's so shady, there's not a lot of lawn type material for a no-mow type turf thing. Although we do have a lawn mix called no-mow lawn mix, which is composed of 6 different fine fescues, which will grow in sun or moderate shade. In fact, I use it for trails in my oak savannas. And as long as I rake the leaves off of it in the fall, because the leaves will smother it, as it will any turf, it does beautifully under the relatively open light of an oak savanna. You know, it's, the trees are touching, you know, it's completely mm-hmm. shaded, but there's enough light that comes in through the oaks and hickories to support this grass. So it's very, very shade tolerant. But if you're in a really dense shade like pines and maples and birches, that's a little shady for any kind of turf. However, there are some natural ground covers which she can use, and it depends on her soil type, so it's hard for me to say. But if it's a sandier soil or well-drained soil, she can use a plant called Pennsylvania sedge. This is one of our Carex, C-A-R-E-X, Carex pennsylvanica, and it looks like a natural lawn. It'll get about 6 to 8 inches tall, and it creeps slowly by rhizomes. You put the plants in. By plants, you can't find seed. It makes very little seeds, so seed is not available. But you put the plants in about 1 foot on center, mulch between the plants to keep weeds down, and in about 3 years, it will fill in to form a nice little carpet of naturalistic sedge, which looks very much just kind of like somewhat long grass. Wonderful option for people in shade to moderate to fairly deep shade under under heavy shade in soils that are well-drained. If you have a rocky soil, clay soil, loamy soil, but a well-drained soil, there's another plant called wild ginger, which if you plant those about 1 foot on center, in 2 to 3 years, they will completely fill in. I use this extensively on my property. I have rocks, okay? I have sand. I mean, I have all the really rough stuff. I don't have any good soil hardly, so that's where the garden is, okay? And this will grow literally almost out of the rock. There's got to be some soil in the rock, but it will creep by rhizomes, and it will cover everything, and it is the only plant I've ever found that will keep out buckthorn, Tartarian honeysuckle, and garlic mustard. It will exclude them. Once they're established and forms a solid mat, they will not enter.
And it's a really lovely foliage.
It's a beautiful foliage. It's all year ground cover. It looks great all year. The flowers are born underneath the leaves. You'll never see them unless you lift up the little petticoats to look at the little flowers. Okay. But it's a wonderful, wonderful plant, and I use it more and more all the time because I don't have to deal with it. Once it's in and it's completely done, it is zero maintenance. It's the only thing I can ever say. It's the only no maintenance landscape you'll ever find.
It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mailer, talking with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. Carly Younger will answer the call and get you through to us. Or you can also email at talk@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about native plants with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nurseries in Westfield, Wisconsin. And Neil, I want to make sure that people know where they can find information about Prairie Nursery, and let's let them know about the upcoming guided tours that are available.
Yes, we have our big spring sale and garden tour this next Saturday, June the 18th, a week from tomorrow. And we have guided tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., and we are about an hour and 15 minutes from downtown Madison, hour and 20, something like that. And we're fairly centrally located in the state, so it's like 2 hours from Green Bay, 45 minutes from Stevens Point, a little more than an hour from Wausau. So it's a great little tour, and all the plants are marked down. Everything must go. It's our big end of the year sale. So, yeah, and if people want to contact us, they can call us at 1-800-476-9454. And with this nice cool weather, you can still plant plants, which normally this time of year it's getting a little late for that, but we've got a week of cool weather, maybe more.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, and we're still accepting plant orders until next Wednesday, June the 15th. So
great.
You can either order online or call us, and you can go to our website at www.prairienursery.com. And prairie is a weird word. It's French, of course.
Prairie.
Oui, madame.
Prairie, yeah.
So it's P-R-A-I-R-I-E, and we always forget to put that I in there after the A. So that's prairienursery.com.
Well, and just to make it really easy, we do have a link from our show's Facebook page, The Larry Mailer Show, to prairienursery.com. Also, we have Prairie Nursery on Facebook as one of our likes on the side of the Facebook page. So you can find them multiple ways. By going to our Facebook page. You know, you were talking about getting rid of weeds and then, you know, seeding and things like that. There was a great question from an email from Dale in Eau Claire. Is there a place on your website where we can identify emerging prairie plants in the spring to recognize if they are good prairie plants or weeds? So far, our web searches only turn up identification guides with blooming plant illustrations. And I have to say, even though you'd think I'd remember what I had planted, every spring I go through that, like, well, that looks familiar, but is it familiar because I planted it or because it's a weed that pops up every year?
Dale, you have just brought up a very interesting story here. About 9 years ago, a friend of mine in Indianapolis approached me and said, Neil, my clients are pulling out their prairie plants out of their gardens because they cannot tell what they are. She said, we have to do a book that shows what the plants look like when they're coming up in the spring. I said, Hillary, how many people are going to read that book? Like 20 of our closest friends. And so we did it. Well, we started it. And this was 9 years ago. We started it with slides, and we kind of monkeyed around with it. And 3 years ago, we got serious about it. So we sent a book proposal out to a bunch of publishers, and a University of Chicago Press accepted our proposal. And the book is almost done, but we went from, okay, it's going to be emerging plants, to, well, wait a minute, you know, we should show what the leaves look like, too. So we got pictures of the leaves, so you can tell it before it blooms. Well, we really should have the flower. You can't have a book without flowers. Well, and then we should show the whole plant.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and, you know, we really should show it in seed. Okay, we'll do the seeds. And then, well, you know, the early seeds, the mature seeds are different. So we have to show early and mature seeds. And, you know, people are always asking me, what do the seedlings look like? Mm-hmm. So the book will contain all of that.
Wow. And so when will that be available?
I'm hoping by end of this, by early next year.
Wow.
So we're hoping to get everything to the, we're doing the final photography this summer. The text is basically done. It's going to be called The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. It will be published by the University of Chicago Press. And, of course, it'll be available on our website and in our catalog.
Great. So well, it sounds like a great resource, because that really is, it's a challenge.
It's going to be an amazing reference book, and nobody would ever duplicate it, because you got to be crazy to do this. It's been an insane process.
But well, we're glad you and Hillary were crazy enough to do it, because I think that really is a kind of an eternal issue that people deal with. Let's go back to the phones and go to Jean in Sauk Prairie. Hi, Jean. Hi, Jean.
Hi, this is Jean.
Yes.
Hey, great program, and Neil is a very knowledgeable guest. I just have a tip for newbies that want to start a small, you know, prairie like in their front or backyard. When we first started out, we used a hand sod buster and found that was very laborious, and then we had to get rid of the sod as well. So my husband kind of came up with a new approach that really worked well for us. He's a contractor, and so he gets his fingers on old pieces of carpet. And you can find this on the sides of streets anywhere in any town. People always pulling out carpet. And so we laid carpet upside down on our whole backyard. I mean, our neighbors thought we were nuts, but we let that sit out there for a whole year. And then as we could afford plants, we just slowly pulled up chunks of carpet or cut off chunks of carpet and installed the plants. So we had weed-free soil, no grass to contend with, and it was just a really easy way for us to work. And it took us about 5 years to fill in our yard completely, but it was a great way to do it.
Yeah, that is a great method, outstanding method, great suggestion. And for people who may not have access to carpet, you know, a lot of people say, oh, go put down like 10 layers of newspapers. Wow, what a pain. And of course, you know, I'm kind of busy, and the only time I have to do it is like when the wind is blowing 20 miles an hour, which is really not feasible. You can, however, go to appliance dealers and ask them if you can have their big cardboard boxes. Mm-hmm.
Like from refrigerators.
Exactly,
and, like
and lay those down if you don't have access to carpet or you want to use cardboard. And what's nice about the cardboard, if you leave that down for a year and you put a little like your lawn clippings, or if you have a lawn, or composted leaves or whatever over the top of it, it will rot at the end of the year, and you can put your plants right in through it and never have to take it up. So there's a lot of different ways you can smother, and the carpet is a great one. Mm-hmm. And like she pointed out, it's free.
I have to say, I have a pretty small backyard, and just kind of making some little paths between, you know, different garden areas and things like that, and actually between hills where I have zucchini and things like that planted. I do put down newspaper, not nearly as many layers as you were talking about, and then put some mulch over the top of it, and it forms kind of a nice little pathway that, you know, is no maintenance, and really nothing comes up.
Works
through
great.
It.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that call, Jean. Let's go to Barb in Wausau. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call. I don't have a prairie garden, but I do have a few wild plants, and I have Joe Pye weed, and every year, this time of the year, I start noticing holes all over the leaves, and I'm wondering what in particular is probably eating on this.
Ooh, boy, that's a very, very good question. I am not an entomologist, so I would not be able to hazard a guess at this, but there are all kinds of insects out there that utilize these plants as their food source. So I'm sorry, I wouldn't know exactly what that is, but I would view it generally as a good sign that you are supporting the local community with your Joe Pye weed, as long as you're not completely stripping it. And
that's what I was
going
to say, Barb. Yeah. Does it seem to be affecting the plant significantly?
Well, the plant always stays hardy, but it pretty much by the end of, you know, another month, no leaves on it.
You know, look under the leaves and see if there isn't some creepy crawly thing underneath there, because it's almost always larvae that are eating your leaves in the larval stage of an insect.
The full insects.
Yeah, and oftentimes they like to hide on the underside where birds can't see them. So look under the leaves and see, and get a microscope, get a little hand lens. out there and take a look and see what might be there. Sometimes they're very, very small.
And you can, if you either catch one of the critters or take a picture of one of the critters, we can have Phil Pelletieri take a look at it. He's our go-to entomologist. So if you get a picture, you can email it to us. And I know Phil's always encouraging people to send him the actual bugs.
And if Phil can't figure it out, nobody can.
Great. Thanks for that, Barb. And Carol in Pittsville. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I just wanted to mention about the pensedge. I'm a professional in forestry. And unfortunately, pensedge can be quite a deleterious to wooded areas if you're trying to get regeneration, natural regeneration. So I would recommend not using it if you have, if you're near an area where you're trying to encourage a treed or forested area.
Does it have allelopathic capacities in that situation, Carol?
No, it just tends to take over. It's just very competitive.
Wow, I wish mine would be more competitive. I have these little patches on my property, and they're just not taking over anywhere near as fast as I had hoped
they would. You have the cooperative sedge, not the competitive sedge.
Yes, you know, it's
pretty
well.
It's probably the soil that you have. It needs a richer soil to really take off. So,
you know, there are a couple of different strains of that, according to Norman Fassett, who wrote The Spring Flora of Wisconsin. Apparently there's a more mesic woodland strain and then a more dry strain. And in central Wisconsin, we have this so-called dry strain, which spreads quite readily. And I think in my woods, which is sandy, I think it might be the more mesic strain. And it's really extremely well-behaved, which I was actually hoping it would get a little wilder. But that's an important point if you're looking for regeneration. I know there are a lot of problems with oak regeneration that come into play, too.
Great. Thanks for that call, Carol. And you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and joined by Neil DeBole, the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We have lots more to talk about, so I hope you'll stay tuned. Neil has great advice and information to share about how you can have wonderful prairie plantings. Great to have you along today for another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, speaking with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We're talking about native plants, how to use them, how to keep the weeds out, and why they're just such a great addition to your landscape. And Neil, we had a request to repeat two things. I think the no-mow grass combination and also the native plant that squeezes out things like garlic mustard.
Okay. The no-mow grass is our little combination of different fescues called No-Mow Lawn Mix. And you can find it on our website at prairienursery.com. And it is very, very deep-rooted compared to most turf grasses. The roots can get up to a foot deep. Most grass roots are only 4 to 6 inch. Lawn grass, I should say. So it's a little more drought-resistant, and it's shade-resistant. It does best on well-drained sandy loam, or even very dry sandy soils.
So not good for a clay soil.
It's not probably really good for a clay soil unless you've got 4 or 5 inches of good loose loam over the top of that clay. Then it's fine. And it will take, again, quite a bit of shade. So if you have a shady area where you can't grow lawn, but you get a few hours of light a day, you can be successful with this. And if you have clay, in that situation, you only need about 3 inches of topsoil over the clay because you have less heat stress because there's less sun. So that's a great option. And then for the woodland wildflower, that is the closest thing I've ever seen to a no-maintenance landscape, it's the wild ginger, Acerum canadense, and it creeps by underground rhizomes and just shuts down everything. And I think it's using chemical warfare because it's
sneaky,
called...
Sneaky.
Yes, there are some plants that exude chemicals from their roots that will retard the growth of other plants and allows them to maintain control of the area. There are many plants that do this. And wild ginger is aptly named because if you break a root, it smells just like ginger.
I was going to ask you if that rhizome, because that's basically the ginger root that we're buying in the grocery store is a rhizome.
Well, it's a totally different. It's not even closely related. They're in totally different families. But it has the same smell and the same flavor. And if you harvest the roots and wash them, there are recipes. You can go online. There are recipes for candied wild ginger root.
Wow.
A friend of mine made it once. It was really good.
Well, and if they spread, like you said, you can dig a few up and, not worry about it.
That's how I go dig a big hunk out and divide the rhizomes and spread them all around my property, and it fills in within a year. They never skip a beat.
Well, we promised people that we would talk about how to control weeds, and we've talked about some specifically, but let's take just a minute or two, Neil. There are some weeds are perennial weeds, and some are actually biennial weeds. Does the control of those two different types differ at all?
Well, yeah, you have annuals, biennials, and perennials, and the control of those is all quite different. And one of the situations people run into, especially when they're dealing with a prairie meadow that they use seed to establish, the first year, it's all annual weeds, because the prairie plants are almost all perennials with a few biennials. So they don't see anything except weeds, and we just recommend that people keep it mowed to 6 inches, which keeps most of the annuals from going to seed and reinfesting the area, and very few, if any, of your prairie seedlings in the first growing season will exceed 6 inches in height. If you didn't mow it, the annual weeds can get 5-6 feet tall and shade out the prairie plants, so that can be a really, really important factor. You have to keep it mowed the first year. The second year is when the biennial weeds show up, as well as your biennial black-eyed Susan, which is a godsend for our prairie mixes, because, you know, most of the prairies don't start maturing until the prairie plants don't start maturing until the third year, but the black-eyed Susan shows up in year two. So, oh my God, there's flowers. Thank God. It's not going to take a lifetime.
Yeah.
Okay. But you also have a number of biennial weeds, and invariably there are seeds harbored in the soil, dormant, that come up during the germination process in the first year, and then they will bloom in the second year. And there are some difficult biennial weeds that you really have to be careful of. Some of them are like sweet clover. There's white and yellow sweet clover, which, if not controlled, can infest the area and come back year after year after year. And the way we control that is by mowing them down to about 6 inches above the ground when they're in full bloom. That usually will kill the plant. Mm-hmm. Now, our second year management for prairies is usually mowing at about 12 inches. And sometimes you can get by with mowing the sweet clover at 12 inches, but if you can get it down lower, that will ensure a better kill on it. You also have biennial weeds like Queen Anne's Lace. Okay, which a lot of people say, oh, isn't that a beautiful wildflower? But wow, watch out if that gets in your prairie. And here, you know, I know this. I had one Queen Anne's Lace in my prairie 1 year. I said, oh, it's kind of cute. I'll leave it. Oh, my God.
You succumbed to its charms.
That's a, you know, that's a kind of, yeah, I did. It's kind of a cute plant. And, boy, I knew better. And next year, it was everywhere. And it took me 6 years to get rid of that doggone stuff. So I would say, don't let these things go to seed. You will rue the day you did that. So there are many others. But then you get into the perennials. And some of the perennials we run into that are problematic are some of the grasses, like quackgrass, smooth brome grass, even bluegrass can be a problem in your prairie. And this is why we burn our prairies in the spring, is because a lot of these cool season grasses will get started earlier than your prairie grasses and flowers, because they come up earlier. Being mm-hmm. cool season, most of your prairie plants are warm season, and they will emerge from the soil later in the year. And so some of these non-native grasses and weeds can start growing 6 weeks earlier, start to lock up the soil environment, the nutrients, the water, and the prairie plants are kind of in second place. Well, we wait until those bad guys come up, and then we burn them in late
April.
And
the prairie plants haven't really even gotten started.
Yeah, they're still underground or dormant or just coming up. They're minimally harmed, and the whole balance of the whole equation changes. So, and that also goes for some of our clovers, like the white clover and red clover. Those are considered weeds in a prairie and can be really problematic, especially in the first 3 or 4 years of establishment.
And one of those perennial weeds is Canada goldenrod, and Julie from Fond du Lac wanted to know how to control that. And if you have any experience on controlling it by cutting when it's in full bloom.
You know what? This is a really sad thing. Canada goldenrod is a native plant. Okay, it is the most difficult weed to eradicate from a prairie. So just because a plant is native doesn't mean it's good. I think I'll plant ragweed and poison ivy all around my property. Those are both native plants. Okay, just because a plant is non-native doesn't mean it's bad. I mean, we're going to send all the apple trees back to Kazakhstan. I mean, you know, so, and corn back to Mexico. But Canada goldenrod is extremely difficult to control. I have tried mowing it when it was in full bloom. It knocks it back, but of course that's the time at which your prairie grasses are coming up and your flowers are coming up. For your late season prairie flowers, it's very damaging to them. Well, not, it doesn't kill them, but it just knocks them back. And it doesn't seem to really hurt the goldenrod that much. We've tried mowing goldenrod at various times of the year. If you mow it too regularly, then you're going to damage the prairie plants that it's invading. We've tried burning different times. That doesn't seem to do anything. The only method that we have found that's effective is to know what it looks like when it's just coming out of the ground in the spring, when it's about 2 to 3 inches tall. And I hate to say this, but we go out there with a broadleaf herbicide and blast it. And fortunately, there's a new broadleaf herbicide out now called Milestone.
Milestone?
Milestone. Google it. It's a whole different animal. It got EPA's reduced risk designation. So you don't have to use these horrible things like 2,4-D and dicamba. I mean, these things smell bad. You know when they smell bad? They got to be bad. Okay, it's like, you know, bad, rotten food or old socks. You know, you don't want to be around that stuff. So Milestone is a whole different animal. You use very, very small quantities, and it's very effective on most weeds. Make sure, as always, read the label, follow the directions. But that is probably going to be your best bet. But it is a broadleaf herbicide. It will kill all the other flowers. So you have to do it when the Canada goldenrods are just emerging in the spring, and they're only a few inches tall. And if you're using like a wand sprayer on a backpack or a little pump thing, you can take a funnel a plastic funnel and cut the little bottom part out of it, so it's just the cone, and then insert it, cut it just right so you can insert it above the spray nozzle. Okay, you can unscrew that and just have it kind of drooped or draped down over the area, so you just have this the cone of death. Okay, and it only sprays inside that cone, so anything nearby will not be harmed. And if the plants are too tall, this doesn't work, of course, because they're too far advanced. And you'll have to go back for two or three times in ensuing years, because you can only do it once a year in the spring. But I have a client who had about 10 acres of this, and he went out there and he got rid of it all.
Wow.
It took him about 3 years, but it was everywhere because it blew in from the neighbors, and he got rid of it.
Let's talk about one more weed and then definitely go back to the phones. There was an email from Tanya in Richland Center asking how to get rid of burdock, and that's one of the biennial weeds that you talked
about. That's one of the biennial weeds, and it can form these huge basal leaves. It almost looks like rhubarb.
It does.
Yeah, but and actually, it is a medicinal plant, and it is noted as being a blood purifier. And I dug up a root once, and, you know, it's an old Ukrainian recipe. You mix about 2/3 ground beef with 1/3 chopped burdock root. Yeah, it's like medicine. It tasted kind of medicinal, you know. It's like, okay, that was interesting. But not to denigrate, but don't get me wrong. I mean,
I've also heard that the young leaves can be used almost like grape leaves for wraps. And Larry said that the stems or the stalks, when they're young, can be kind of like breaded and made kind of like zucchini sticks.
Well, I've heard of the zucchini sticks. I didn't know about the leaves. That's interesting. So, you know, nothing is all bad, you know, but it can be highly, highly competitive.
And it's huge.
It's huge. And they're kind of cool.
Yeah.
And, of course,
they look kind of prehistoric almost.
I think they are. And they have these seeds, of course, which are like Klingons. Okay. And actually, it was the burdock that was the inspiration for Velcro.
Really?
Yes. Oh. It's those little Klingon hooks on there. But how do you get rid of it? Because it can be a really invasive plant. You can do it totally organically when the plant is in bloom. Okay. Which it's a biennial, so it blooms in the second year. Take a narrow, sharp spade, like a tile spade, and just above or just outside the plant, take it at a 45-degree angle into the soil and sever the root about 2 inches underground and pull the top of the plant up so you know you severed it. If you do that when it's in bloom, that's it. It kills the plant. Very similar to mowing down the yellow or white sweet clover when they're in full bloom. Apparently, with most biennials, if you can sever the root below the soil or mow them down to the ground when they're in full bloom, it's a susceptible time for them when a lot of their energy is coming up from their roots into the plant and into the flowers, that it actually kills them.
Huh.
And this works great on burdock. It will kill it every time.
Great. Thanks for that advice, Neil. And I'm sure that Tanya in Richland Center is very excited to hear that it's going to be that easy to get rid of. Let's go back to the phones on Steve in Platteville. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, Neil. Steve from Platteville. I got a small prairie, and I thought I had it eradicated before I planted it, but then as years went by, now I have the quackgrass came in, and I have burning nettles, and I don't know if burning nettles are good or if they're bad, and Queen Anne's lace, and I know you touched on a few bases, but what's the best way to get rid of quackgrass in a prairie?
Okay, and this is already in your prairie?
Yeah.
Okay, and the nettles are also in an established prairie?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about whether nettles are good or bad. You can make great nettle soup from the leaves. Make sure and wear gloves, okay, because they do sting.
Carly, our on-air producer, is giving a thumbs up for nettles.
And it also is a host plant for some certain butterfly larvae. So, like I say, nothing is all bad. I mean, even poison ivy, birds love the seeds. So it's not really good for us, but birds benefit from it. But quackgrass, the nettle, you can, it's rhizomatous, so it spreads to form patches. You can go in there with a dandelion digger wearing gloves, and you can just dig it out and follow the rhizome. Okay, it's relatively easy to do. Okay, that's what I do. I get it occasionally in my prairie gardens, and I do that, and it comes right out. You might have a little remnant rhizome that you didn't get. It'll resprout. Go back in and get that, and it's usually gone. Quackgrass, on the other hand, is much more difficult because there's no magic bullet for getting rid of quackgrass or other cool season grasses. So, as I mentioned earlier, the best thing to do if you have a quackgrass infestation in your prairie is to burn it, usually in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, the third or fourth week of April. And this is to be timed when the buds of the sugar maple tree are opening. And what I found over 30 years of burning prairies is that if you burn your prairie when the buds of the sugar maple are just breaking open, and not the red maple, not the silver maple. They're usually 2 weeks earlier. And you're usually looking around April 21st to April 30th. This year it was like May 6th. It was so late. May 7th in northern Wisconsin, I think it was, you know.
Which is about right. They were saying everything was about 2 weeks
late. About 2 weeks late, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, some people bring prairies all the way into the second week in May, depending where they were located. But at this point, the quackgrass is up about 6 or 7 inches. It has expended root reserves to make the new leaf growth, but it has had no time to resupply the roots with photosynthate from energy that's made in the leaves. So the roots are now weakened. And the same would be true of brome grass, bluegrass, or other cool season grasses. And you burn them at this time, and it deprives them of that new growth. And their bank account, if you will, of energy in their roots is depleted, so they are set back. The soil turns black. The sun shines on it, and the warm season prairie flowers and grasses come roaring out of the soil, and they have a huge advantage. You can turn a quackgrass-infested prairie into a beautiful prairie in 1 year by doing this.
Wow. Right?
And if you do it a couple years in a row, you'll really get a control of the quackgrass. If you cannot burn it, then mow it right down to the ground. I mean, to the dirt, as close as you can to remove as much of the new leaf growth. And then if you can, rake it off, because that exposes the soil to the soil, to the sun, to warm it up. Okay, mm-hmm. And this will really turn things around. You might have to do it a couple years in a row. Generally speaking, we like to burn every other year because it maintains a good balance between flowers and grasses. If you burn every year, you tend to push the balance more towards the prairie grasses, away from the flowers. If you don't burn for 3 or 4 years, that gives it time for woody plants and other invasives to get in there. And once, say, black locust or a box elder or a buckthorn seedling is more than 2 years old, it tends to become well enough established that if you burn it, it will not kill it. And so it will come back despite your future burns.
So every other year, it sounds like, is a good balance.
Every other year works best, and we divide our prairies into two management units and burn one year and rest the other. And it's just a flip-flop them back and forth. Mm-hmm. And you'll find also that different birds like to nest in the old dead grass growth, and other birds like to nest in the new green grass growth. So you create a more diverse ecosystem while you also maintain biodiversity within the prairie plants themselves.
That reminds me, Neil, on the Facebook page of Prairie Nursery, there's some amazing photos. I would really recommend people go in and take a look through that album of photos. And there was a picture of a nest that you guys found. And was it a chipping sparrow? Was
yep.
that right?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Lovely little nest with, I think, 4 little blue eggs in yep. it.
And they have the most beautiful little nests. It's just amazing. And the engineering feat that is required when these birds make these nests in the plants is really something else.
Great. Yeah. So take a look at those photos. You'll be inspired. Thanks for that call, Steve. Let's go to Jim in Green Bay next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Or good afternoon. I'm sorry. It's afternoon.
That's
now.
Okay.
I've got a question for your host. I want to know from Door County, Brown County, Oconal County, and part of Marinette County, I received a letter from the Department of Natural Resources that they're going to be spraying all the shoreline with my permission and everybody else's permission for Phragmites. This Phragmite has been quite a problem in this whole area along here, which some of them get to be at least 12 feet high. I have quite a bit of an extensive shoreline, plus I've had a lot of depth of my shoreline. And I was mowing it to a certain depth of about 500 feet and trying to create kind of like a wildlife prairie with little small flowers and everything else. What I'm wondering is, when they spray this, what's going to be replacing these Phragmites if they get replaced? From what I've heard, I think this stuff is probably the hardest thing there is to kill.
Yeah, Phragmites is really hard to kill because it's another one of these rhizomatous invasive non-native plants. And if you dig them up, you will see these huge rhizomes. They can be almost an inch in circumference, and they have a huge amount of energy. And you can go and like take a bulldozer and push it around, and it'll just come up wherever you push it. It just doesn't quit. It's amazing stuff. And as you pointed out, it gets 12 feet high. It has a huge ability to compete with other plants. I don't know the specifics on their program, but I suspect, Jim, that they're going to be spraying this with a grass selective herbicide like we talked about earlier, Post or Fusilade or some formulation like that, which typically will kill the grasses, but it will not kill your flowers and will not kill your sedges. And so what they're trying to do here, I'm sure, is try to recreate the sedge meadow effect, or the wetlands sedges dominated ecosystems that preceded the invasion by the Phragmites. So I'm pretty sure that's what they're doing. I'm not familiar with the specifics, but that would be logical what they're trying to do. And hopefully it will work because, I mean, for instance, the the west side of Green Bay was a phenomenal habitat until it was filled with fly ash brilliantly by the power plants there in the 1950s. And people used to come from all over the world to hunt ducks in southern Green Bay. And they filled it in with fly ash, and it all grew up to Phragmites, and the whole habitat was destroyed. I know they're trying to fix these things, but it's a huge problem, and hopefully they'll be successful.
And it seems like Jim could probably contact whoever sent that letter, too, and ask specifically what type of herbicide they're using.
I'm sure they've got to have a contact information there, a website, or somewhere we can get that information, because that's typical when they do a big project like this. They want to make sure the public is aware of what's going on, so you're educated, and make sure that you don't have any problems with this if they're going to be spraying your property. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that, Jim. And let's go to Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I'm not like the hardcore gardeners that you guys have been talking to. I just want to try and grow some catnip down in my little valley that we if you're familiar with the area of Pigsville, it's right next to Miller Valley. It's super wet all the time, and I just want to know what's something I can put out there that someone who works two jobs really doesn't have to care that much about and can come out, cut it, and give it to his cat.
Okay. Catnip is a non-native plant. It's in the mint family. And what I suggest, Chris, is that you come to my house and harvest all my catnip and take it home with you. Because for me, it's a bit of an invasive plant. It's not terrible. It grows in my alkaline soils in my woodlands. So if you want to grow catnip, it seems to prefer a little bit more alkaline soil, which I suspect you probably have there in that area because those soils tend to be clay-based. It doesn't like wet feet, though. It does better in a well-drained soil. So I don't think you're going to have very good success if your soils tend to remain moist. But be careful what you wish for, because once you have catnip, if it goes to seed, you may find that if it likes where you are, you will have lots and lots
really
of catnip.
Likes it, yeah.
Which, you know, if that's what you want.
Well,
that's
and you know,
great.
It sounds like, and actually, it being in the mint family, this is often recommended for mint family things. Grow it in a container, and you can even sink the container into the ground if you want that sense of it being planted, but then you can also it contains it.
That's a great idea, but make sure the seeds don't get out, because then it's all bets are off and it's off to the races with the catnip.
Thanks for that, Chris. And let's go to Jim in Chicago. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hello. I live on the northwest side of Chicago. Converted my front, got rid of 50% of my lawn, have rain barrels, and have blazing stars and a lot of other flowers, and my neighbors are pretty happy with it. And I planted sumac, which provides a nice cover for my patio. And then in the wintertime, you know, I get the sun coming in, which I want the solar energy. But the sumac does red.
Yeah.
And it is nasty. So how could I contain it? How can I control it a little bit? I mean, I pull things out here and there, and that's what I have to do. It's maintenance.
Yeah. Most sumacs, if I'm not incorrect, I think all sumacs are rhizomatous, and they spread by underground runners. And did you plant the staghorn sumac, the smooth sumac, fernleaf sumac? Do you know which one that was, Jim?
The staghorn.
Staghorn. Okay, yeah, that likes to move. And of course, you have the beautiful, beautiful red and gold fall colors. A stunning plant. And of course, you can make a nice tea out of the seeds. It's very nice tea. It's kind of lemony flavored. But it spreads, and it spreads rapidly. In fact, I have gone mano a mano with that stuff and pulled the rhizomes out of the ground. And believe you me, it is hard work.
And who won?
I won. Oh, yes. I got 15 acres of buckthorn that I've eliminated at my property, so I can take these guys on. But anyway, point being is that you need to put some kind of containment structure around this plant. And I suggest 18 inches deep of quarter-inch stainless steel. No. That might be a little extreme, but you need to put something in there. And, you know, if you just put that little plastic 6-inch edging in, it'll push it out of the way. It'll go under it. You really need to go down at least 12 to 18 inches to contain a plant like that. And then you have to make sure that the containment, whatever it is, plastic or metal, something that will not rust and deteriorate, because then it'll punch through it. And you should have it about 2 to 3 inches above the ground, too, because some plants can creep rhizomes over the top of that. So
they're sneaky.
They are sneaky. So good luck with that.
Thanks for that, Jim. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about how people can take care of their prairie plantings or their native plantings at home. But Carly, our on-air producer today, pointed out that there are opportunities where you really don't have to have a lot of knowledge, but you can gain a lot of knowledge by helping out. And so we posted just a couple. I'm sure there are other opportunities, too. On the Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, we have links to volunteer at the Arboretum here in Madison. Also, Prairie Enthusiasts does a lot, and you can learn all about how to eradicate invasive species and things like that. And we're actually going to be talking about invasive plants next Wednesday. with some folks from the DNR. So that'll be good. Bonnie also posted a link to the Wild Ones, which we had mentioned earlier, a group that works a lot to preserve biodiversity and things like that. So, Neil, we're almost out of time. I want to remind people that Prairie Nursery is having an open house on Saturday, June 18th. Tours at 10 and 1, and they can find more information at prairienursery.com.
That is correct.
Great.
Yes.
It's been a great discussion with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. Thanks for coming, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
And I want to let you know that Monday at 11, Larry will be back. He will be talking with physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Time Brody. Thanks for listening.